You're listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent in Birmingham, Alabama, a church with a heart for the gospel. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.
Dear God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Well, a very warm welcome to everyone who's come to this second class on finding peace in the last third of life. And this is the book that concerns that subject, Finding Peace in the Last Third of Life. But the talks are not slavishly at all. I don't even refer to the book except it's in my overall thinking and heart. I will quote it at one point, but this is simply reflections on finding serenity and possibility and optimism rather than introversion and deepening mild depression and useless repetition and often alcoholism in the last third of life. And so that is why I'm pitching it really to everyone, because A, we're all going to be there, and secondly, if some of these dynamics of human relationships and God could be grasped by a person in the second third of life, it would, which it rarely is, it almost never is, unless there's a catastrophic emergency, and then it is. But very often, it's not grasped until the body itself begins to be a daily catastrophic emergency, and there does seem to be an openness to kind of talking about the hard side of it in a truly honest and repentant manner, in which God almost always, I would say always, seems to work. And so what I want to start out with, and as you know, the first 10 minutes of every talk is entirely indifferent. I used to say I could read the Hoover telephone book for the first 10 pages, because we're getting settled and people are thinking about whatever they're thinking about, and you gradually have to focus in. But this is a talk about really the way forward in when you don't see a way forward. Now, the worst thing that people do, and remember what I said, if you're retired or thinking about retirement or on the pivot of retirement, hopefully this may immediately speak to you. But if you're not, it's intended to anyway. And I believe it will. Many of these principles I wish I had understood clearly when I was 40 and all the stress of professional life. I mean, I look up at Dean Smalley and I know what his life is actually like in terms of the inwardness. I know the stress of it. I know the interpersonal problems. I know that personnel problems are always the biggest problems you have. If you run a car dealership, what are your biggest problems? Personnel. Lawsuits. The possibility of lawsuits, difficult people, people you can't fire, people you don't want to fire, people you adore but are moving on. There are a million different stresses of running any kind of institution from middle management right up. And so it would be so wonderful if one could find the inward transaction to reclaim a daily life of perpetual stress to something like promise and hope and enjoying getting up in the morning. Now, for someone who's retired, the worst question that is asked every single day is, what are you doing with yourself these days? That is the normal question. And people ask questions because they don't know what to say. Forgive them. Forgive them when they ask questions, because they just, Father, forgive, because they do not know what they are doing. They just want to have something to say. Oh, how's your daughter? You know what I mean? Or, hey, in other parts of the world, how's the weather? You know, whatever it is. But it's just a way of, but when people say it, it's inevitably comes across as a judgment, even if you're having a fruitful time. What are you doing with your time these days? I hate you. With me, the characteristic question is, and I've heard it about 177 times, "Oh, Paul, are you writing these days?" And of course, the moment someone asks that question, I resolve never to write again. That's human nature. Remember, we're talking about human nature. And as soon as people ask me, give me some form of advice or good counsel. Craig was referring to that, how all the different people who advised him about a problem he was having they'd better to have been quiet, like Job's comforters weren't. So I'm thinking a lot about Motown these days. I'm sure you are. And you all will remember the greatest song in many ways of certainly Diana Ross and the Supremes. We found ourselves living for about 8 years a quarter of a mile from Diana Ross. She was never there, but it was so interesting. But her greatest song is "Got Him Back in My Arms Again." And probably half the people here can sing it without even knowing who sang it. "All day long I hear my telephone ring, friends calling me to give advice. From the boy I love, I should break away, 'cause heartaches he'll bring one day. I lost him once through my friend's advice, but it's not gonna happen twice. 'Cause all advice ever gotten me was ever long and sleepless nights." Now, that song is profound. Like most good rock and roll, it doesn't matter if it sounds just like popular music, because it's written by people who understood inevitably. Why was that song number one in what year? 1965. It's number one in the country because almost everyone here has had friends call in to give their advice. And all the different things you say, and often they're right. Probably 80% of the time they're correct. But because it's advice, it's that not only are the questions superficial, but they're obnoxious. So what I want to say is, the first thing is, I'm going to give you a fundamental picture of what human existence is like, even for a retired person, or specifically for a retired man or woman. But the question will always be, how? Now, I said last time that T.S. Eliot's, one of his inspired lines was in East Coker, one of the four quartets, where Eliot wrote at a very young age. He was about 26 when he wrote this. "Old men ought to be explorers." And that has always struck me, old men ought to be explorers, as a tremendously wonderful possibility. Wouldn't it be great? Or middle-aged men ought to be explorers. And the question is, Paul, okay, but how? How can I be an explorer? I don't feel like an explorer. I'm not an explorer. I'm basically in a state of moderate to low-grade depression most of the time. And like Paul McCartney said to Linda Eastman in 1969, confessing to her and her alone, when she said, "To be honest," he said to her, "there are days when I cannot get up in the morning." So I can tell you to be an explorer, but how? I cannot give you imperatives. I can only give you indicatives in the presence of God. Let me repeat that. I cannot give you an imperative. You ought to be an explorer. Get yourself together. What's the matter with you? You're just sitting around all the time watching TV or binging on whatever it is. I can't tell you to be an explorer, but before God, you can tell me what it feels like to be the person you are, the indicative. Always look for the indicative, not the imperative. So we're going to talk about how might one imagine becoming an explorer, a person of promise, a person of hope, a person of desire in the early morning. How might that happen? But before I do, I have to explain a mistake that I made last week. I made a mistake in the class because I made a point that mattered, but I didn't explain it. I didn't explain it properly. Do you remember what it was if you were here? It doesn't matter if you weren't. I said that Herr Moltmann, Jürgen Moltmann, it had a tremendous impact on Mary and me when he said in middle years, he said, life is not about action consequence. Life, speaking as a Christian, is about death resurrection. In German, that's tun ergehung, action consequence, versus tot, death, and auferstehung, resurrection. And what did I mean by action consequence? Action consequence, and Mary said the obvious truth, it simply means if, then. That's what action consequence is. If I act in such a manner, then a certain consequence will happen. A certain thing will happen. If I behave in such a way, I will be rewarded. If I behave in a negative way, I will be judged, attacked, dethroned, and I will fail. So that's the way we live. Most of us believe that action that we live by, if I do this, then I do that. And what's that called in theology? It's called the law. If I do this, conditional, then. And the trouble with it is it breaks down in reality. It's an inaccurate narrative. Now remember, one of the biggest things, today we talk about narrative, which is just a new way of saying some kind of paradigm or some kind of overarching idea we have about our life. And the question is simply, does it work? If I believe in if, then, does it actually work? If you're 25, or if you're 45, or if you're 85, I'll bet you that any number of people here would say, well, it worked in this, perhaps, or maybe it worked over there, but with my husband? Are you kidding? With my child? No way. With my profession? I mean, you know, you're supposed to get tenure if you're an academic. Anybody here a professional academic? You never get it. You spend 20 years being working as an adjunct faculty member in St. Louis, hoping that one day you'll get an assistantship at Kenyon College, and then maybe you'll get an associateship at Vassar. And then inevitably someone else you've never heard of who comes from Southeast Asia gets the job. So, I mean, and you've knocked yourself out. Any of you have a child who's tried to be a professional academic? 90% of the time it goes wrong from that point of view. Every so often it goes right, but it turns out, you know, I was talking to somebody the other day, a very good friend of mine who wanted to get his name is Aaron Zimmerman, because he wouldn't mind. He's an Episcopal minister, a Mockingbird fan. And he said, my father was a Moorhead Scholar at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, he said. And all I wanted growing up, all I wanted going to high school in Charlotte or wherever it was, Raleigh, North Carolina, was to be awarded a Moorhead Scholarship at the University of North Carolina. And he didn't get one. So he had to go to Harvard instead. The day he didn't get it, I don't think he'd even applied. I think it was through his high school advisor. What I'm trying to say is, even if it works that way, if then is an inaccurate a description or narrative, but death, resurrection, and we know this because in John's Gospel, Jesus said something that I have always resisted, but unfortunately it's accurate. He wrote this, he said this, if a seed falls to the ground and dies, it produces much fruit. If a seed falls to the ground and dies, it produces much fruit. I would say, personally, that describes the story of the lives of most people I actually know who found their way forward in life, and especially at an older point of experience, that something had to die in order for something new to come. And again, I resisted it. I still resist it. But it's an accurate narrative as opposed to an inaccurate narrative. You may disagree, and I hope you have found it not to be the case. I used to say that there were only two people that I ever heard of who never had a fall professionally, and well, actually, it was Beverly Sills. Beverly Sills was a Metropolitan Opera soprano, and she was the biggest intellectual in New York, and everywhere she went, they loved her, and she never seemed to fall in my life. And I said, Mary, I just wish I could be Beverly Sills. Now, that's an old name. I think Barbara Streisand had a similar profile until recently. But I thought, you know, at least there's Beverly Sills. But then it turned out, you know, you find out something. And so the question is, if life is about death, resurrection, that's heavy. Let's say it's about loss and recovery, or it's about sin and forgiveness and fresh movement forward. How do we become explorers in an older age or in our experience? Now, the phrase that I've used, you've heard it, it's called assimilation of negativity. That's just words, and this will be the last time I talk about it in this situation. Frank Lake was responsible for that. Frank Lake was the brilliant, genuine psychiatrist, fully qualified medical psychiatrist with some history of psychoanalysis in England. But because of the charismatic renewal and his deep background in the world of evangelical Anglican Christianity, he was always trying to apply what he learned about the human individual psyche to what we know in the Bible about sin, redemption, and hope, and resurrection. And it was he that told Mary that the key to a forward life was the assimilation of negativity. It's his phrase, which is to say, if there's negative circumstances or negative situations or negative experiences, our normal tendency is to want to not talk about them or to suppress them. That's not bad. It's normal. Mary got a text, an email the other day, don't worry, from no one here and no one important, but important to me professionally. And she said, oh, so-and-so's in deep trouble. And I immediately said to her, she said, so-and-so's in some real trouble. And I immediately said, I don't want to hear it. I didn't want to hear it. I don't want to hear it. And if I can do that about someone I care about who's not even here, who's way away, who's in deep trouble, what does that say about me? The last thing I want to hear about is experiences that are highly toxic and negative and hurtful, especially if they've been with me for a long time. I really would rather not talk about them at all. But they're there. Now, what happens in life, as you know this, is that we're on a train. Right, we're driving a train. We're conducting a train. It's going down the track. It's Paul. It's you. We're going down the track, and it's going okay. But there's another train that's on a parallel track, and that train is called the pain train. So you've got this train. I'm driving the train, but there's also the pain train, and the pain train most of my life is ahead of the pain. Is behind the regular train. It's not catching up with it because I've taken all sorts of steps to make my life go well and happily and married the right person or had the right kids or found the right profession. But at some point, the pain train catches up with the regular train. And that's when the change happens. It's when the pain train comes to be neck and neck with the train of my life, and the pain train inches ahead of the previous train, and that's when change powerfully happens. And if you want to go home, if you like rock and roll, the Guess Who, the greatest Canadian group of all time, I say that to Dean Pinter, the greatest Canadian group in 1965, 66, did a song called Pain Train, and it's perfect. Pain Train. Don't listen to it. It's about when the pain train overtakes the train, but that is the moment of profound power. Now, I'm going to give just two examples, and I'm going to say what needs to happen is you need to be able to say what's really driving the train, what's really happening in the presence of a loving other. That there's no other way. That there's no alternative. The loving other may be all sorts of possibilities, but the negativity is healed when it, in its full and complete, or to as much as you can, painfulness and hurt is able to be expressed in words, hence in feelings, in the presence of empathy and love. I would call it abreaction in the presence of love. And when that happens, to quote Romans 8:26, the Spirit intercedes for us with sighs too deep for words. Now, I happen to be married to someone who has been gifted by experience and a little bit by genetics and upbringing, but as much as anything by experience, someone who is truly empathetic. And if you can, and Mary is whom I'm talking about. And if and I, not a wife and a husband can really do this for each other because they're bringing so much, you know, baggage, as it were. But someone can. And to be able to say to someone what really is going on, which one just doesn't. I don't care what you say. You will say to somebody that you love and care for about half of what's going on, or maybe a third of what's going on, which is a lot. Conceivably, one time in your life you said 67% of what was going on, but you very rarely ever actually said the whole and the deepest hurt and power. And this is the the essence of what the Christian answer to stuck emotional life in older age, it's the answer, it's the antidote, it's the possibility. And I'll just give a couple of examples. First, I'm going to read a passage, then I'm going to talk about the Twilight Zone, and then I'm going to, we got plenty of time, and then I'm going to talk about Yves Montand, the French genius, and then I'm going to read one other passage in the Bible. And this is, it's actually about Mary. There's a passage when I talk about Mary, but I'll skip that part. This is a passage on page 60, which I will read. This is the passage I will read. It's called When You Are Heard, and it's in my book on page 60. The word abreaction is a technical term within the practice of psychiatry, but it is a useful one. Abreaction is the term for what happens when your suppressed emotions are enabled to come to the surface and be felt. Previously tamped down, previously slammed down feelings are expressed, and the expression involves tears and sometimes anger. Didn't Betty Davis warn her guests before a dinner party with her friends who were Broadway stars to, quote, fasten your seatbelts, it's going to be a bumpy night? That's from All About Eve, 1950. The director of that movie and his wife were members of Our Son John's Parish up in Bedford, New York. I mean, as soon as I heard that, I said, take the job. Are you kidding? Now, abreaction is a bumpy ride, both for the emotional patient, quote, and for the witness or listener. For abreaction to take place, both the speaker and the listener have to alter the terms of their normal emotional discomfort. When a person is holding on to pain from the past that has not been processed or even acknowledged, that pain is bound to surface with powerful external effect. Now, one more paragraph that's important. This actually happened. Once, an elderly lady we knew, who lived alone in a small New York City apartment, was injured severely and thrown into a state of clinical shock when, during a Manhattan heat wave, she opened a can of peaches that had been sitting forgotten at the back of a kitchen cabinet for 5 years. As the lady started to open the can, it suddenly exploded. All the peaches literally blew through the small opening she had made and hit her as well as every wall and surface in her tiny kitchen. She had to go to what was then called St. Vincent's Hospital and be treated for shock and superficial injuries. Also, her entire apartment had to be repainted. The instantaneous and titanic geyser of de facto pureed canned peaches was so high pressure that it even reached her tiny bedroom and bathroom. A year later, she died in that apartment, and I was there when the police and superintendent had to break down the door in order to find her. There were still many signs of peaches on the walls. Something like this is what happens when permission is given for hidden pain to get out. The good news is that you almost always feel better and more peaceful after the release of the feeling. It's been pent up too long, and as the birds sang in 65, I'll feel a whole lot better when you're gone. Now, that is really what has to happen. That is really the characteristic way that God works. That's why Jesus is always inviting people to tell him things. Every encounter, with very few exceptions, it involves someone saying something very major. You know, my beloved servant is at the point of death. I don't know what to do. Or I'm about to be stoned, and I don't even have words to express the threat that I feel. Or my son throws himself into the fire because he has mental illness and nothing seems to work with his fits of epilepsy and so forth. And so if you read Jesus's ministry in the light of this, you see that it is the abreaction of a suppressed pain or loss in the face of directly mercy, empathy, and compassion. And that is the essence of what has to happen to you and me always. Remember, Jesus also said in Luke chapter 12, he said, "Nothing that has been covered will not be exposed." Now, that's a heavy thing. But all it means is, if I'm carrying something left over from my high school years, and many people are, many people have been in fatal accidents, or have known someone, or were with someone who were in a fatal accident after the prom. Many, many people. You don't know it. They won't tell you. William Inge, the playwright, talks about this all the time. Probably not you. But you may have, in fact, been involved in something pretty grisly when you stop and look at it. But the last thing you want to do is ever stop and look at it. But until it's looked at, you might as well forget the possibility of healing. Well, I'm going to close with a final kind of summing up. But before I do, I want to invite you to go home and see an episode of The Twilight Zone from season 2, 1960. Season 2, The Twilight Zone, stars Brian Ahern and, wait a minute, I think Pippa Scott. I always get Pippa Scott and Piper Laurie confused. It stars Pippa Scott and Brian Ahern, and it's called The Trouble with Templeton. It's a work of, in my opinion, I'm going to overrate it. Oh, hey, it's nothing. But it's about an older actor in New York whose much younger wife is probably being unfaithful to him. And he has a kind of butler type of thing, and he's very, very despondent and very, very upset. And it's obvious that he's not where he should be, and he's playing in a Broadway play. So he goes downtown to rehearse in this Broadway play where this once famous actor is now going to have a revival of a play. You get the idea. And he's so upset by all the different things that are going inside his head, that he and the director is a young whippersnapper who starts yelling at him. You know what I mean? It happens in the ministry. This young whippersnapper starts, and he's so upset that he bolts and he runs out of the theater. And suddenly, he's in the year 1927 when he was young, famous, and there's a restaurant. And he doesn't understand it. And he walks into the restaurant, opens the door, and he's back in 1927. And there is his original first wife, played by Pippa Scott, and a couple of other people. And he suddenly is back there in a very, very painful period in his youth. But he's him. And he suddenly realizes that not only is something terrible going on in this situation from the past, but that he had romanticized the past in a way that was completely misinformed. He was wrong about what he thought was happening. And he's just undone. And Rod Serling, I mean, it's genius. They're occasionally genius. Rod Serling was not a genius, but he was close to one. And he suddenly realizes that the whole, everything about his life is suddenly in a trice, in a quick, boom, he sees it. And he's healed. He's instantaneously delivered of his complexes. And he runs back. And he, I don't mind, it's a spoiler, but the thing has been out for 47 years. Okay. I love it. People say, you know, Pride and at the end of Pride and Prejudice, Elizabeth Bennet, and then it says, spoiler alert. I want to say, are you kidding me? You know, Hamlet dies. But he runs out, and he's back. And he's literally, in a minute, he's healed. And then he tells off the whippersnapper. He achieves real power of being. And he goes on stage with incredible elan and confidence and hope. And it's called The Trouble with Templeton. And it's you and me, I think. So the key, we're going to finish, the key to an optimistic future is the unsuppressed facing of prior pain, which I realize is almost impossible, in the presence of total mercy and empathy, which as Christians we believe God in fact is. So that's why I'm not seeing this as a prescription towards something bad. This is a prescription towards something wonderful. Now, next week, I'm going to, the last of these talks, which ties in, is going to be called Life After Death. Next week is, what can we say, and I believe we can say some very wonderful things, what can we say about our life after death that is helpful and sustaining and comforting and deeply affecting? So thank you all for coming, and I look forward to seeing you soon. God bless.
You've been listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent. If you live in Birmingham or find yourself visiting, we hope you will join us at one of our Sunday services. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.